You're listening to After Images, a podcast for cinephiles that takes a deep dive into moving images. Each episode features a special guest who is invited to explore a film of their choice. After Images is hosted by film writers Franck Bouleg and Marisa C. Hayes. On our 19th episode, we are joined by author Mariana Enriquez to discuss the first season of the anthology crime drama True Detective. It's been 10 years since Nick Pizzolatto's creation premiered to universal acclaim on HBO. Directed by Kerry Joji Fukunaga and starring Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson, the first season of True Detective is set in rural Louisiana and spans a period of 17 years, opening with the investigation into the ritual murder of Dora Lange. Imbued with elements of cosmic horror and philosophical pessimism, strongly influenced by the Southern Gothic, the season dives into the psyche of the case's two lead detectives while taking its audience on a spiraling hunt for a serial killer. Along the way, True Detective evokes the painful legacy of slavery and social class, while exploring concepts of cyclical time, grief, and the influence of Robert W. Chambers' short story collection, The King in Yellow, among others.
Mariana Enriquez was born in Buenos Aires, Argentina, in 1973. She is the author of the novel Our Share of Night, several collections of short fiction, like The Dangers of Smoking in Bed, shortlisted for the Booker Prize, and also works as a journalist. Her work has been translated into 30 languages.
Mariana Enriquez, welcome to After Images podcast. Thank you so much for joining us today.
No, thank you so much for inviting me. It's a pleasure.
So for today's discussion, you selected season one of True Detective, which I think in recent years has become such an iconic piece of television. Could you tell us why you chose this and what season one of the series means to you?
Well, I think it might be my favorite piece of television personally. There's other television things that I think maybe are better in quality if I get like a critic, like Twin Peaks, for example, or more iconic. But this has been kind of designed for me. I love Southern horror, Southern Gothic. I love cosmic horror. I love the whole pessimistic, nihilistic ideas behind it. I find it interesting, not that I love them, but they're very gloomy. But I mean, I really like occult themes. I'm a fan also of noir and characters also like Rust, that it's a bit a mystic and unbroken. At the same time, so there's everything, all the references. I mean, I remember watching it and screaming at every reference of things that I loved. And yes, so I think it's the TV series I can, I fell in love instantly. And I'm still in love with it.
Did you feel it's something that you could have written?
I wished, yeah. Mm. Yeah. There's some things that in the first view, we can go into that. I watched it several times, and in the first view, I remember I really didn't like some things, and then they started to, I started to understand them, or maybe it's me, and I kind of made my own puzzle of it, and everything fell to where it was supposed to. But I wished I would write something like that. I would like to write something like that. Mm-hmm. But you need those actors too.
Mm. Yeah, it's such an incredible tour de force for the lead actors in that season. And it's also interesting that it's one television season written by one screenwriter with one director doing everything. And I think for American television, at least at that time in 2014, it was still something quite special and unusual to have that kind of authorial voice. Do you agree?
Yeah, because it gives an atmosphere. I mean, the writing, it's what it is. It's amazing. It's very, there's a lot of talk. That is something that I really like. It's very common to have the two detectives talking, but still it's a lot of it and it's very heavy, the talk. That was a genius casting because you're casting actors that are not only brilliant, but are friends. So the chemistry is already there and everybody knows they're friends. So you really like watching people play and exchanging ideas in a way that it feels really natural, maybe because it is. And but also what Fukunaga does, the director, with the atmosphere in the whole series is very special because it's only one, I think, only one episode is the episode where Rust, it goes undercover to infiltrate this gang of bikers and drug dealers that has a completely different approach, but still it still even when he has that that sequence that never cuts at the end, is 6 minutes of never cutting, there's like very accomplished technical things going on there. It still is, the whole series is in a way a maze. It's even said directly, like it's a maze and this monster at the end of it. And the projects in that at night, even is a completely different approach to the rest of the filmmaking. It's kind of a maze where he's running inside of it, and maybe the monster is him, is himself. But the coast of Louisiana, with its natural beauty and also the evident rural poverty and the, let's say, invasion of not exactly industry, because it's not industry, but the extractivism of oil. It's kind of, it's a wasteland. So the whole time, not on that episode, it's different, but in the rest, the whole time you're watching a wasteland. And there's not that atmosphere. It's only possible if you do it with one director that really gets that we are exploring a land that has been abandoned here. And that is dying in a way. It's very decadent. The whole situation is very decadent, but this land is a land that is dying. It's dying because of the hurricanes. It's dying because of the extractivism. It's dying because of the corruption. It's dying because it's forgotten. And that is something that he can create with images, but also with mood. The mood in the images, I mean, the everything that he chooses, it's quite amazing. So yeah, I think it was, I don't think they got along very, very, very well, which is also interesting, because sometimes happens between creative partners that the best stuff comes when there's some kind of friction. And yeah, it happened. It didn't happen in the other seasons. They are not that bad, but you know, they don't have that kind of precision.
And you mentioned this role of the landscape and also the fact that you enjoy Southern Gothic. And I'm wondering about this relationship to place that becomes like a character in the work, and the fact that your own writing has often been labeled or compared to the Gothic as well. Could you maybe tell us a little bit about that relationship to the Gothic and the sense of place?
Yeah, well, the Gothic is very based on the sense of place. But the European Gothic with the castles, with the cold, with the old abbeys, with even with the cities. But it's different cities. It's the very dirty industrial cities. It's very distant for me. Because for me, place is a character. In True Detective, place is a character. The coast of Louisiana is a character. And the Southern Gothic being American Gothic, American, I mean from the continent, not from the US. It's in a way New World Gothic. So it implies a different kind of power that it's falling or has fallen a long time ago, but the land is still has its evil imprinted on it, let's say. Louisiana, the coast of Louisiana, what happened there, and what does the family that is the family behind the ritual killings, what have they done? Well, they had, because since there's no problem spoiling it, the killer lives in an old plantation house. So it makes it very obvious that it was a family that now is exploiting other kind of disadvantaged people, but they made their money to make that possible with slavery. So that's a crime that it's in the land, and that the land remembers, and that cannot be erased. There's no way. Even if they come, the two detectives come, and they basically they get the baddies, but they can't get all of them. At one point, Russ says, "We didn't get all of them." And Marty says to him, "We can't." And that means not only that they can't get the whole family, but they can't erase what has been done there. And also in the rest of America, of the rest of the continent, to me, the Gothic, it's very similar to the Southern Gothic, because wealth in general is in the hands of big families that inherited the earth, the land. Then that's also part of the Christian kind of imaginary that it's in the show. And it's in the way that these families that are also very religious, all of them, got rich. They got the land, and they got the land in the rest of in the US too, but also in the rest of Latin America. They got the land from the indigenous people and built by the further south you go, but more indigenous people than slaves. But indigenous people treated as slaves. So this is a wealth that has to do with the landscape, in the sense that that landscape doesn't mean freedom or beauty, although it might be beautiful and it might look free, but that land has an owner. And that owner made its fortune of that land with blood. Most fortunes are done with blood. But this is a direct connection with the landscape. I mean, you have those empty spaces of land in Argentina, for example, because they are owned by someone. It's not they are empty because it's the pampas that is flat. They are empty because there's cows there from someone that is very, very, very rich and made inequality something that is persistent and equivalent. So to me, that kind of, you know, sociopolitical reference to the Gothic in the Americas is much more near to me than the Southern Gothic, the tradition of the Southern Gothic, than in Europe. And the families, of course, because since we don't have royal families, since we, you know, that's the basis of America, is that we've got independence from the kings, but we do have the extended families that are, of course, in Southern Gothic, absolutely prevalent. Think Faulkner, for example. And that's direct, that's realism. That's the big extended families that have the power, that they are not aristocrats, but they are. And they also have, like in True Detective, the, you know, the bastard children that are very resentful. And so there is something to me literary and personally that you would say, but how, if you're from Argentina, well, you know, we have more things in common with South America, has more things in common with the US than with Europe, and also more friction.
But there's a lot in what you just said, but I really like this idea of the landscape related to the Gothic in the sense that you've mentioned the landscape as something that is spread in space, but also as something that is historical. There's a historical landscape of families and of inherited traits that come from former moments in the past and connected with the Gothic. And at the same time, you talked about the maze figure, which I think is also interesting in relationship with Rust. And I think that Rust is really the center of the vortex of all these themes in True Detective, because my feeling is that this vision of Louisiana, this vision of the world that we see, is basically an expressionist vision of his own psyche. Would you agree with this?
I mean, in a there's two, but there's many, but two versions of the classic labyrinth of, there's more, but through two that interest me in particular in True Detective. One is the classic one, that it's the, you know, Theseus going into the labyrinth and killing the monster with the aid of Ariadne, that it's Marty in this case. And there's a way out. And the other one that is not an opposite to that is what you can call it, that like the rhizomatic labyrinth that also happens here, is that you open branches, one branch, another branch, another branch. And that is kind of what Rust does, both of them. He's in both of the labyrinth. I mean, he is in the one where he with a lot of reluctance accepts the help to get the monster, that it's the real, let's say, monster, but it's also himself. And I always wondered the burden that he has, the guilt that he has, and the kind of his whole pessimistic, nihilistic view of the world, and he's basically his anti-natalist philosophy. I think it comes after losing the child, and I don't know why. I think I remember the first time I saw the series, I thought that he was the one that by accident killed the child. But then I saw it again and I said, he doesn't say that, but it's an effect of the prof how profound is his pain and his guilt. It's like there's something else here, because he never explains the accident. He tells the accident to Maggie, to Marty's a wife, and he talks about it several times, and he says there was a car, and he always stops himself there. So we lived in a corner and there was a car, and what happened? And I always thought that maybe he was, you know, taking the car out of the garage and you know, stepped on the girl, because it's that kind of, is that kind of grief. It's a grief that is very, the grief also with a child, I think, always implies a sense of self, It's your child. So if it dies, it's kind of you failed your child in a way. So it comes with a little self-hatred. But this is beyond. And so I always thought that, but it's not the case. At least in the iceberg. I don't know what's going floating underneath, but I always thought that that was happens. But anyway, the other labyrinth is the one that has no way out because it's all its branches. Branches opening, opening, opening. You never find the monster because you are always veering from it because there's one theory and another theory and another theory. And that's what he does during all those years that he's not there. And basically in the second, when the second investigation begins. But these two labyrinths that are obviously also represented in the in how they are marked with the spiral in the back, the victims and the and also the cultists are not incompatible. I mean, both things happen. It's a non. Pizzolatto doesn't choose one of the two for his detective because, of course, the mind and what in a way Rust decides that he thinks because he decides that in a way, the mind is elastic. So at one point, if you decide to go out of the labyrinth, you can, and or you are capable of, let's say, it's not maybe you can't, but you are capable of. So I guess that is super super smart. And as many in many pieces of writings, I don't think that he thought about it that much at the beginning, or so in depth that there's two labyrinths and there's two monsters on this and there's two and there's two Russ gets out and doesn't at the same time. So he gets out with his life having killed the monster and probably a little bit more able to live his life without so much suffering. But the work is not done and will never be done. His grief will never be appeased. And the grief of the world, let's say, will never be appeased. And these people will never be stopped. So that's super, super smart that he does both things. But I don't think he thought about it before. It just happened in the writing.
In this second, I'm sorry, in this second version of the maze that you're mentioning, would you say that it might be slightly Argentinian in the sense that it is the Garden of Forking Paths of Borges? Is that the model that you're talking about?
A bit, yeah, a bit like, and it's also a very, I in 2000 when it opened the series in 2014, the paranoid thinking, and the conspiracy theories were there, but I don't think they were pop culture like they are now. Like today, people just think like that. And make connections like that all the time. It happened in the pandemic, it's happening all the time with rich people. And I mean, you see the series now again, and it really looks like conspiracy theories that a lot of people take as truth or really believe that there's a cult of powerful people abusing children, and and Hollywood is in it and whatever. So, but those days, it wasn't that obvious, the paranoid thinking. So that is very special too. But the garden of many paths, I don't know how you say it in English, it's this idea of multiple points in time, dots that you connect one thing and with the other. And paranoid thinking is a bit like that. At first, it can be, an investigation, and at one point, it really veers to insanity. when you say, okay, there's four letters here and there's four, I don't know, cars here. So one thing and that, then, and it's a very thin line.
Mm-hmm.
And there's many times when Marty, that is kind of the voice of reason, the voice of the common man, says to him, okay, this sounds very crazy and you are going, there's many, many times where he says, you're going, this is crazy. And it's not. But what's kind of, because that maze is a maze, it's a mental maze. That maze of connecting things is what keeps you up. It's amazing that's true crime and the prevalence of true crime these days and many true crime shows and many people obsessed with true crime is that. It's connecting dots. The times that I've been let down, I don't listen to true crime anymore because I've been let down so many times because it's just, or many of them, are just people connecting things and getting nowhere. So now that kind of thinking is kind of prevalent. The paranoid conspiracy thinking is kind of prevalent, which is very scary because you are in a labyrinth where you can't get out of. And it's also, it makes reality, that is another theme of the series, seem like a veil all the time. As we are, you know, recording this yesterday, there was an attempt of assassination of former President Trump. The first thing yesterday, I was talking to friends like everybody was at night. And the first thing was a friend of mine that seems very normal most of the time said to me, I think it was orchestrated. And I'm like, but it was from far away. It's too dangerous to be orchestrated. If you say to me that they shot his leg, maybe.
Yes.
But in the head?
Yeah, 10 centimeters away from the brain.
What? How much? He was doing very good in the polls anyway. So I don't think he needed to risk his life at that point for winning the election if he can win it anyway. But and this is a person that seems very, very rational in the rest, but there's something in his thinking that, and it's in True Detective kind of anticipates that. And it's that's sometimes as good art does that.
Yes.
It becomes prophecy of its own time in a bit like Ballard. It's not like Ballard is not really talking about the future. It's like taking elements that are already in the present and taking them very, very far. So the investigation that it's, you know, opening itself like that, when you get to that, to the place where Rust is with all his stuff, he becomes also an accumulator in the same way that the killer has become. They become mirrors of themselves. And it's classical procedure, but that's also his mind. And his mind is like, that's entering the locked room that he mentions in previous episodes, as the mind has been this locked room where the dream of life happens. And then you enter his locked room where his investigation is going on. And that's the locked room of his mind. So that really resembles, that's his mind. And that's very scary, is that we are like, I love Rust as a character. And he, to me, he's very attractive. He's hot. I mean, but that is, you know, like Heathcliff, you know, that kind of the Blakean demon is that kind of super, super, you know, Superman of Nietzsche kind of idea. But that has become, you know, the flat earth, flat earthers now, with time is a flat circle. I don't know. There's many, many things in there that later, a few years later, have become like a common sense, when Marty is supposed to be the common sense, because Rust, I love him, but he's borderline psychopath. But he is a psychopath, functional, but, you know. And I mean, yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing what they've done. And without, you know, write those things without thinking that much about it.
But in terms of this idea of the labyrinth and all of the different layers that are at work in the series, I wondered if we might talk about some of the intertextuality happening in this season and the different references to Robert Chambers, The King in Yellow. Some people have spoken about Alan Moore's The Courtyard and some links with the character of Rusty Cole. Just wondering what you think, you know, you've mentioned some of the mythological and philosophical ideas that are also at play in that intertextuality. What are some of the references that stand out to you and enhance our appreciation of the season?
Well, first, he takes the whole cosmic horror tradition, the imaginary that he chooses is not Lovecraft, it's Chambers, but then Robert W. Chambers, for the readers that wrote a book in published in 1894, I think, called The King in Yellow, who's American. And the King in Yellow, that in the series is called the Yellow King, but it's the same. It's very similar to, and then of course Lovecraft takes a lot out of it. It's just a couple of short stories. It's not that much. It's not an immense lore, but it's very subtly scary. And what implies is the same of Lovecraft. There's a god king in another dimension, that it's the real dimension, this world being not the real world, but something that it's behind. It's a spectacle. It's something that when you break it, when you go, let's say, to the other side, you get to that real world, that it's a world of horror, and it's a world of power, and it's a world where we are puppets, and we are puppets playing to, you know, to the music of, in this case, the King Yellow, that lives in the lost city of Carcosa. And there's a few references in the whole series about Carcosa, obviously, but also the black stars that rise in Carcosa, and also the mask that works in many ways, because the King in Yellow is supposed to wear a mask. The story of the King in Yellow is not in the short stories, but it's in a play that is referred to in the short stories that you're not supposed to read because you go crazy, the same way that you're not supposed to read the Necronomicon because you go crazy, or to see the gods in the Lovecraft mythology because you go crazy, or you become a devout, devoted, religious person to them. But one of the most scary, I think, parts of The King in Yellow, in the little fragments of the play that are there in the book, mostly as epigraphs at the beginning of the short stories. And in one of them, the woman in the play says to the King in Yellow, you can take, not the King, he is the King in Yellow, but it's just the guy at that point of the play, says, you can take off the mask now. And he says something like, I'm not wearing a mask. And she says, no mask, no mask. There's a scene in True Detective. At one point, both of them rescue two children. One is dead, they don't really rescue them. One is dead and the other one is catatonic from the den, the cave of these two cultist killers and pedophiles, and also drug dealers. And the girl, Kelly, it's in a in a psychiatric home because she never recovers. But at one point, Rust goes to see her to see if he can get some information. A kind of very cruel scene. And she doesn't really pay attention to him until she remembers the face, and she says the face that really resembles that part of the King Yellow, the mask. And then, of course, cosmic horror really as Southern Gothic, amazingly, relies on extended families and its monstrosities. If you read something like The Shadow Over Innsmouth in Lovecraft, it's a young man that goes to Innsmouth, that is this town, and where he somehow sees the cult, sees the result of the relations between the gods and people, that is these hybrid creatures when they have sex, and afterwards. It's a long thing, but afterwards realizes that he is one of them too. He's a hybrid creature too. It doesn't really show that much. But the idea of incest and mix, it's very much in cosmic horror and in Southern Gothic. And I think one of the relations is that, well, obviously Lovecraft was a racist, like massive racist. I would say that he was... a white supremacist at this point, if you read especially his letters, his horror, his fear, his deep horror was of that people being mixed, which is kind of the sin of the South, the horror of white people not being the owners of it. And that's why all the beauty of the land, the beauty of the houses, the beauty of the plantations, the beauty of the furniture, the beauty of the architecture, the beauty of the food, the beauty of the cemeteries, everything that is really beautiful in the South is impregnated by this original sin. And the same, it's the opposite in Lovecraft. It's, everything is horrific, but the fear is the same. It's the fear of mixture. And then you have a new, of course, the mythology of this also Arthur Machen with his he's British, and he has this this late 19th century, and he has the whole idea of place as something that you can't really control, that nature has its own mind, and that mind is controlled by all gods, but in this case mostly the god Pan. But of course the god Pan is has in the name panic, so it's also very related to horror and fear. And also when you meet the great god Pan, for example, the short story by Machen, also if you meet him you go crazy. The thing is that Rust has met this other reality in his beliefs, and also I think in some plane of reality, in that mixture of grief, going undercover and becoming a heroin addict, ending up in a psychiatric hospital too and getting out of there, and in that place that is only referred to, there's not even a flashback, is the time where he met that other reality where everything is horror, and where this reality seems like a veil, seems like absolutely unreal, let's say. He met the reality on the other side. And the author that Pizzolatto uses for this is, well, there's many, it's the pessimistic philosophers, like Emile Cioran, in a way, in the anti-natalist way. There's another one that's a Norwegian that's called Peter Wessel Zapffe, that it's recommend to you, The Last Messiah. It's crazy. It's from the 30s. It's like, the man is very, very bad. But I think the main one is, because of all these references, is Thomas Ligotti. Thomas Ligotti is a contemporary horror writer, very much in the vein of Lovecraft, but a much more accomplished writer technically. He has a bit of surrealism too, like Twin Peaks fans would love him a lot because of his idea of, the Black Lodge is there all the time. And but he has this idea of this reality is just, theater. And there's another one. And horror starts when you meet that other one. And horror fiction happens that way when there's no more language to tell, to talk about it. Like reality has a bit of, it starts to get weird and more weird and more weird, and you deny it and you deny it. And then that weirdness impregnates everything, contaminates everything. And then it opens the door to the other reality. And in horror fiction in general, there's no more language. That's what Ligotti does. But also Ligotti is kind of, he's a recluse. He's absolutely a man of, many troubles, I guess. And he wrote this book that is a conspiracy against the human race that Rust doesn't really quote from it, but it's very near. I mean, there are some very intense Ligotti Lovecraft fans that even tried to get Pizzolatto and HBO take them to court for plagiarism. Plagiarism is not really a legal term. It's a copyright infringement is the term. But anyway, as a writer, I know these kind of things. But it's like a moral thing, mainly. And Ligotti never said anything. But there's many things we should kill ourselves because the fact that we have conscience is a mistake in evolution. It's something that Ligotti takes from Sapfe, from the Norwegian philosopher, puts it in more simpler words and terminology, and then in True Detective it's even more easy. But it really, really, it's similar, and in many parts it's similar to Ligotti. So there's a whole family tree of cosmic horror going on through the whole series in philosophical fiction, lore, etc. And very, very smartly put with Southern Gothic that has things in common with that. And so that, for me, were the reference that stand out the most. Like the first time they say Carcosa, I was like, whoo! Because I have, I have pins and, I have three versions of the King in Yellow. And I was like, why in television, what in true crime, not true crime, but in thriller television, made with a lot of money and superstars and stuff, are quoting this very, to me at that point, very weird shit. Mm-hmm. And I was absolutely amazed. And at the same time, I was a bit like, I don't want people to know about this. Mm-hmm. Lovecraft, everybody knows, it's okay. But, Chambers and Machen and Ligotti, this is my stuff. This is the stuff of the freaks. Mm-hmm. We own this thing. I don't know. I don't want this to be popular and, people to make memes out of it and stuff. Mm-hmm. But they won me. it's very well done.
So do you think that Cole made Nietzsche and Schopenhauer cool?
Yeah.
More seriously, you were talking about the maze and mythology, and listening to you, I was thinking, and especially when you mentioned the fact that he had reached beyond the veil to this dark realm of cosmic terror, if there was not also something of Icarus in him, because you're talking about the black stars, and I've got the feeling that he flew too close somehow to these black stars and got burnt with, and his name is Cole, isn't it? I mean, it's like all. I mean, he's been burnt. He's a dark stone himself, isn't he?
Yeah, and rust also is, you know, it's kind of not the word in English is not wasted, but it's kind of, yeah.
Corrupted.
Spot, yeah, damaged.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, not burned, but yes, burned, but not by the heat, but by time.
Mm-hmm.
And so yes, I think there's the Icarus thing. If he flew too high, but not because of ambition, maybe, or maybe yes, but just out of you know, looking to escape. In a way. And then he has, of course, a lot of the Blakean, the Blakean Satan that has fallen because of his rebellion. And in a way, the Blakean and also the Milton Satan is quite moral, if you think about it. Like he's... Why should we obey you if you're not that great? Like, it's a rebellion. It's not a rebellion of they're arrogant, they're beautiful, but it's not a rebellion that comes from being evil in themselves, but it's a rebellion that comes from being disobedient. And Rost is disobedient. He's there, he does the job, but he's disobedient and he's disenchanted in the job, I mean. And he has fallen, he has done his job very, very good in the same way as Lucifer has. He was the best, he was the favorite. He was the best. I mean, he was was chosen to be underground, to be to do that. You have to be very good in what you do. He's the best interrogator of all. He's super cruel in his interrogations. And yet he's not accepted by the institution, let's say, at all. And he's of course very attractive, and so there's some and the way that he kind of confronts with Christ in his little room, in his little Spartan room, he has pictures of dead people and a crucifix, and that crucifix he uses to say, he says to Marty, he uses for meditation. And for meditation on what? And it's a meditation of if it's worth it to, it's how much pain can you endure? Is it worth it to give yourself or give your life to another? And it's also a confrontation. All the time. It's all the time there to, you know, him to kind of tell him why do you give hope to a hopeless world? Why you're so cruel? And so, yeah, that's a lot of all that, those the figures of the hero, like Theseus and also the figure of the falling angel. In Icarus, that is obviously a fallen angel, but also Lucifer, not by way that much of the scripture, but by way of the romantic and, you know, symbolist vision of it, that is much more compassionate. Because obviously there are aesthetic traditions that really are in love with rebellion and beauty.
A Kenneth Anger Lucifer.
Yeah, exactly. That kind of thing, yeah. Well, with the biker gang, there's so many things. When you go, and it's like, yes, of course, and the biker gang is super, it's super homoerotic.
Yes.
There's no women in the show.
It's true. Yeah.
And I don't think that's, to me, that's not a problem. You know?
Just to add a little something perhaps to this link between Rust and Fallen Angel. I mean, he's the one who keeps seeing birds in the sky making spirals. Yeah. He's the one who sees the vortex at the end. I mean, he's always looking up and seeing things beyond in the sky in a very Twin Peaks way, I have to say, as in 11 with the vortex as well.
Yeah, absolutely. But that in the end is the... it's the thing that distracts him, because that in the vortex that he sees in the end is the way out of this life. Many times he says, I shouldn't be here, meaning I should kill myself. And many times he says, I don't have the constitution for suicide, which I don't think is true. And I think Marty at some point says to him, you sound really panicked. And it's true. He still thinks that there's something for him here, and he doesn't know what it is, but I mean, it's very unlikely that he doesn't have the constitution for suicide, because suicide doesn't mean that he has to commit it himself, but he couldn't be killed easily that night in the projects. Easily, it's just, you know, turn around and you get shot. You know, you lose a bit of concentration and you get shot. So it's not, suicide is not just a conscious act, but you're also letting yourself die when you're in that kind of situation. So I don't really believe him. He is really eager for being alive. And at the end is the moment that when he sees that and he says, okay, this is, he's distracted that, because that's the very first time that he has the possibility of just going there. And that's how he gets the guard down and he gets attacked by Childress. I don't really know how to say, but Errol, let's say. And that vortex is very Lynchian, of course, and it's also very Machen. It's like it's a portal. It's the portal to the other reality that I think he has seen, or more or less seen. That's why the flocks of birds and the synesthesia, he's been near. I don't know how near, but he's been near enough to be very curious about it and to go there again, which in a way he does in the end.
I was wondering if we could come back to the theme of children, because you mentioned the grief. Yeah. It's very important for the character of Rust. But I've also thought of a few other instances where we talk about children. You know, Marty's family is falling apart. He has a very complicated relationship with one of his daughters. There's also the moment where he feels very fatherly in a prostitution ring towards a young woman who he thinks is too young to be there. And so he tries to assist her and then later enters into a sexual relationship with her. And I'm just thinking about this idea of childhood. It's where trauma begins. But we also think about it as a special magical time that children are in touch with senses in a different way that adults who have been formatted to behave and think in a certain way. I'm a big fan of your writing, and I'm currently finishing Our Share of Night. And so I'm also thinking about the relationship to children. I'm just wondering, in your own writing and in the series, how do you address, or how do you think about, conceptualize the role of children?
Something that really made me fall in love with the series was the very unromantic view of childhood that it has. The children that we see are children that are, even the killers, I think Errol and Reggie and the Wall were all, if not abused, they were, you know, were victims, of course, but they were witnesses of abuse. We see almost what happened to Marie Fontenot, the girl that disappeared, but we know that she was ritually raped and murdered. And it's borderline grotesque and too much, but it's quite borderline to doing it good. It's something that I really, when I write, I really struggle with, because to me it's very important, as we talk about the, you know, this reality and the thin veil. I think there's a thin veil put on childhood, because childhood could be both. A child, as a child, you know, has this relationship to the magical world. It's very, you know, fascinated by imagination and imaginative tales. And this same child could live in the street. This same child could be abused. This same child could be unloved. This same child could be... There's a very strange idea, I think, of... you know, pretending that childhood is the best part of life, and then it all goes down from there. That has nothing to do with reality. It's a fiction that we live with, because we know that most of the abuse of the children happens in the house. It's not the children go in the street, you know, in the park, and someone picks them. That's extremely rare. It happens in the house, and it happens with the family. And children get sick. Children in my countries, children live in the street, in the cold, children beg in the streets, children are born from mothers that are addicted. Children are abandoned by parents that, you know, go away. All kinds of things happen. Being a child doesn't protect you from the evils of the world. Rust at one point says, when he's at his most pessimistic and in the depths of grief, I guess, says at one point, it's beautiful in a way. I'm not quoting directly, but it says it's beautiful in a way the way my daughter died, because she died before, you know, being someone in this grinder of meat that is life. And that's, of course, his philosophy, but there's something about the way that we deny the humanity of children. And we think that they are these, you know, creatures that are, you know, like floating around in happiness. Mm-hmm. That I think contributes a lot to this silencing of children, and we as a society not being able of seeing their suffering, because we deny it, because we can't stand it. And that's a flaw. That's a flaw of adulthood. It's like a flaw of, you know, we are failing children because we are ridiculously fragile and unable to acknowledge the damage that is being done to them. So I try to work with that a lot in my work, I think, in my writing. I think it has to do a lot with, I was born during the dictatorship in Argentina, the last dictatorship in the 70s. So my childhood was very, not entirely unhappy, but I wouldn't say happy at all, and very, you know, very, it had a lot to do with the fear of the adults, of growing up in a reality that was very difficult to comprehend when you were a kid, with a lot of even lexicon that was absolutely insane, like my father coming home and saying, from, he was working in a factory, as you know, he had a very good position in a factory, and but still he couldn't prevent any of his workers, let's say, to save them. So he would come home and say something like, Miguel has been taken. And was it taken by what? It really sounded like something outer space or something. And basically, who's disappeared? That was equally scary. So, and that all the children that we went through that are in a way traumatized to several, to different degrees. My degree is a very, let's say, mild degree because no one of my family was directly, you know, disappeared or dead. That is like the maximum. But my parents were very unstable psychologically, having go, you know, through that and having to raise a child in that world. So, and I have many, many friends that do, you know, have much more violent relationship with that, and they're very traumatized because of that. And many are even kidnapped. And then they got their identity back. So that's, you know, that's to say that my view of childhood is that childhood is not this paradise, but it's something much more complex. Because in that terrible childhood, I was all the time reading and having my fun and, you know, doing my things, my children things. But, you know, the reality was that, and I was very scared and I was very anxious and it was kind of awful. So all the children that we see in True Detective are like that. Even the children are very protected, like the Marty's children are very, very protected. But the girl that in the end we see that she is on psychiatric medication by just a line that the mother says. She is a very rebellious teenager, like very, you know, punk gothic and having sex in cars, which is absolutely normal. But she's the child of a policeman. And this policeman happens to be Marty, that is kind of a womanizer and also very, you know, Puritan at the same time and ultra protective of the girls because he's ultra scared of the girls. But at the same time, as you said, he's having sex with one of the young prostitutes that he, like Marty is a mess. But he recognizes that he's a mess. But that girl, when she's very little, she does this, she's playing with dolls. And she kind of reproduces one of the crime scene of Marie Fontenot. And that's never explained. So you kind of wonder, did she look at his father's papers? Like Marty many times is drunk and passed out. So, you know, maybe she looked at it. Did that happen to her? Are people in the community talking about it in any way? I think that sign is that even this child, loved, protected, popular, you can see that she's like a very, you know, kind of vivid and, you know, liked girl, smart, conventionally pretty, even this girl knows about darkness. And that is something that to me is very interesting. Of course, when you deal with these things, especially in this kind of medium, the line, and this is Southern Gothic in a nutshell, the line between exploitation grotesque is legitimate, and there's a lot of grotesque element, is thin. But sometimes you have to walk in it when you do genre is like that. When you do any genre, the lines between the things are much more, the genre is not something delicate. It's genre is kind of a warning. It's popular fiction. So popular fiction is not supposed to be very careful with these kind of things. Which amazes me is that I don't think this can be done today, 20 years later. It's become a lot worse.
It seems to me that all the elements that you're mentioning about the relationship to children, about the violence done in the family, and all of that can be somehow connected to Twin Peaks. To me, it's very similar. And even actually the first girl who is found is very reminiscent of Laura Palmer that she's portrayed and everything that goes behind it. Could you comment perhaps on the links that you see or don't see between Twin Peaks and True Detective?
Well, there's many because Twin Peaks is too dense. I think it's like a macro kind of reference. But a few things that are to me are very obvious are in that first scene, for example. Dora, it's on her back, but it's basically it's the same kind of image, like it's, and also the fire. The fire is never mentioned again.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that it was at first, what you see first is the fire, because the killer is kind of cleaning the area, so you can see her, because she's not in the middle of the woods. That fire walk with me kind of reference, and the woods reference, and that she is in the woods and stuff. That's never mentioned again. To me, is clearly a nod to, and because it's the first, almost the first scene, also in the two series, the woman and the incest, of course, and the incestuous relationship. The main difference, I think, and all the children, and the main difference in a way that it's also important is that, of course, the detectives are very different, because the detectives in Twin Peaks, they have a lot of irony. This only Marty has irony, it's different. They are not realistic, let's say. They belong to another kind of narrative. It's a narrative that is much more surreal. This tries to be the most realistic and gritty that it can be. They are not gritty in the at all, and they're kind of funny. But there's something that is also very similar. That is the sexualization of women. Which I insist I don't have a problem with when it's done the way it's done, because to me the lover of Marty, I can't remember the name now, but this the lover that he goes to the house and destroys his house and breaks into her, is Alexandra Daddario, the actress. She's very Audrey in a way, even. She looks a bit like that.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it's kind of very obvious. The Black Lodge, the idea of the sect in the, and the idea of another reality that is basically what, it never happens in True Detective. But it does happen in the third season of it's explored in the third season of Twin Peaks, and in fact he comes back from it. he's been trapped there, but Twin Peaks goes much more further because it's its own genre in a way. But this tries to, it's like a Twin Peaks hides behind the procedural crime thing, and it's nothing like that, but True Detective is.
Mm-hmm.
It quotes, let's say, it cites Twin Peaks in many ways, but it doesn't pretend to move to another genre. And also the way that Lynch treats that other side, it's much more Freudian, it's much more psychological, it's a clearly a dark state of the mind. You can say that Carcosa is a dark state of the mind because you don't really know what Carcosa is. Like for some, it's a state of the mind. It could be also the den of the killer, but it doesn't, it's really where the crimes are done in the end. But in Lynch is absolutely different. But also, I mean, even the bar that's called Longhorns. There's something, you know, there's little references there, like he's saying, yes, I know I know that something exists that is this, but I want to keep in the procedural, you know, cop drama.
Actually, the bar in the second season is more reminiscent of the one in Twin Peaks, isn't it? Like this
yes.
place that is a bit outside of time, that is abstract, and where you can meet people from the future or the past.
Yes.
In this case, it's very relevant, all the references to Twin Peaks. But for Franck, Twin Peaks is such a foundational text that he has to say it every podcast.
Sorry. So I see that we've already been talking for 1 hour and 10 minutes. We would like to hear, if that's okay with you, what you are currently working on and what are your next projects?
Yeah, I am working on a novel that is, I don't know really what it is, but it has a lot of ghosts. And if in A Share of Night I was working a lot with the notion of family, it's very gothic in a way, the notion of family, heritage, landscape, etc. In this one, I want to go more urban kind of thing. And but still weird and still its own kind of mythology, but a different one, more rock and roll, let's say. And what else? I want to write a comic book, so I'm trying something like that. And I'm doing a non-fiction thing on the history of my readings, and that is going to come in a collection of you know, writers talking about their how they educated themselves with their readings. That mine apparently is like a very weird. And what else? Well, that's about it. But yeah, it's a lot of things. Yeah.
Weird is good. And for our listeners, I just wanted to mention, I believe it's just this year that the English edition of A Sunny Place for Shady People has been released.
Yeah.
So that's the latest short story collection, right?
Yeah, I think it comes in September or October or something like that.
Fantastic.
In yeah, but it's done. I mean, it's just it's very different, you know. I think, I mean, I don't think people will find it that different, but to me, it's much more melancholic and yeah, less it's the like the I think more to the old definition of the ghost story, that is kind of the sad ghost, not that much of the scary ghost, you know. It's still horror and fantastic fiction, but the vibe, I think, is kind of different.
And what about the translation of your biography of Silvina Ocampo?
Yeah, that comes in August. It comes out in August in France.
Okay.
It's very interesting because that's a book I wrote almost 10 years ago. And of course, Silvina was the best friend of Borges and wife of Adolfo Bioy Casares, that is, you know, one of the most important non-realist writers of Argentina, not that very known abroad, but very important to our tradition, and the fact that we are not in the Spanish-speaking world, we're probably the country that is less realistic of in their literary tradition. And even, I mean, Borges translated the Wild Palms, for example, of Faulkner. I've read Faulkner first time translated by Borges. That doesn't mean that it's a was a good translation, because he made it very Borgian. And there's not, I can think of two writers that are more different than Faulkner and Borges. So it really doesn't read like Faulkner at all. But the plot was interesting. And anyway, and she was a writer that was very well known, was very well reviewed, but nobody read her because she was very strange. She was super cruel, the way that she treated children. Her children are evil. They are little demons. The way that she treat desire was very feminine, in the very, you know, very good definition of what feminine desire is, that sometimes is mixed up. I was thinking about that when we were talking about True Detective, and then I will do a little, you know, if you excuse me, a detour to talk about that. And so they asked me to do a biography. I couldn't do a biography because she has a mecenas. I can't say the name in English, but someone that has all her stuff. There's not that much. The only thing I wanted to know, she kept a diary, because that is kind of fundamental, but she didn't. So I could, with the things that were there, do a biography. And she, it's amazing because she, you can see the way that her sensibility didn't connect with the times, because that was totally unexpected of a woman to write about in that style, those kind of things. But now she could be a writer of today, a short story writer of today. Now she kind of, I think she found her audience, and also the mental possibility of being read, because there was no way that they were like, what? She's writing a short story about being, you know, trapped to a bed and raped, and this is kind of surrealistic, because it's not like a, it's in a very oniric kind of the way memory works and traumatized memory works. And that was a short story in his first, in her first book, sorry. And I think that was in the 40s. It was like, what? Like, women don't, I mean, that doesn't happen to women at first. And then they don't talk about it like this. And then this doesn't happen to a woman that is like uber rich, she was more than a millionaire. So, yeah, so it's a biography of her, and she was very extravagant. So there's a lot of weird shit there. And I think that knowing her life, she's dead forever now, but knowing her life and her people of her class, I think, helped me a lot to write Our Share of Night, because to that point, I've never met rich people. That kind of rich people. I, you know, nouveau rich, of course, but aristocratic, old money, old properties, properties in the middle of the jungle, you know, kind of thing, and that are abandoned, but nobody sells it because they're so rich that they kind of forgotten about the mansion that they have there. I mean, it's crazy. And I've never, 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 ever met someone like that. And in, you know, in 6 months, I met 20. So I started, like, you know, taking notes of that, like, this is the rich family that I need. And that I had only read in books.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, and still in the novel, I think most of it I took from books anyway. But I had the experience and the, you know, the information. No, the only thing I wanted to say, and this is in the relation to Silvina and the female gaze, let's say. She was a woman that was 12 years older than her husband. Adolfo Bioy Casares was an amazingly good-looking man. And there was a lot of talk about this, because she was not, I think she was gorgeous, but she wasn't conventionally beautiful, especially in the way that beauty was, you know, codified in the 40s, that kind of, you know, and in her class, of course, she was like wearing men clothes and not painting her hair. And, you know, it was very, she didn't wear dresses or jewels, and, you know, it was very different. And she wrote a lot about that, about jealousy, about, you know, the fascination with beauty and possession and all that kind of things. And I think it's very relevant of her writing and her position on that, on how desire of women is portrayed. And I think something that happens in True Detective, that it's kind of, I don't think Pizzolatto thought about that. And many of the male reviewers at the time, And women too didn't think about that because they're kind of very comfortable with some with a you know very specific way of speaking about things. So naked women are objectified. Men, if they are not presented in a very sexy way, are not. And so this is blah blah blah. This is always exploitative of women, and these are all femme fatales and crazies. And it's there's a part where Rust really, I had a lot of fun watching it again, that says to Marty, "You, how can you not spot crazy pussy?" I mean, that phrase, do in this climate today of super, you know, woke kind of, it would be like, I they barely got away with it into 2014, but now it's absolutely impossible. But something that has to do with female desire is that something that is very difficult even for women to recognize, especially with the obligation, let's say, of being a feminist and, you know, this not being with romantic love and choosing healthy relationship and self-care and self-love and stuff, is that a man like Rust, broken, insane, that kind of ignores you, that has a very kind of strange sexual attitude, because Marty is the one that in a way has a more healthy sexual, he has desire. What Rust is like, nothing. That is a fantasy of women, like absolutely prevalent. I mean, absolutely prevalent in the way that if you get the new Taylor Swift record, one of the songs is called "I Can Fix Him." No, really, I can. She's 34, she's like the fucking superstar of the world, she's the role model of the girls, and she's saying, "I want this broken man to fix him because this erotizes me. It's not just about moral and being a mother, but I think this is hot." And that is a problem, you know. and sexuality and eroticism sometimes is a problem. Desire is not something that you can put morals to. And it's not something that you can put a lot of rational thinking in it. And that the desire to fix something beautiful that is broken, empower, and that will empower you, is totally wrong in many ways, but it's a total fantasy. So I think in that series, the one that is more objectified is Rust,
mm-hmm.
not the women. And the women are objectified in the very kind of common way, but he's objectified in the way of the female gaze and female desire, which is something that we sometimes, I think, has to be more in the conversation as to, I don't think that's a bad thing. I mean, it's amazing the way that, I don't think anybody noticed that, but if you do a bit of a Google search, you will see how much of a sex symbol the man is.
Yeah.
And it happens to me a lot also in Our Share of Night, for example, in the novel. Like Juan, Juan is a beast. Mm. He's awful.
Mm.
And they're all in love with him.
Mm.
I mean, I put Gaspar there, he's so decent and nice. And I put Luis, his brother, that is equally pretty and he's super good. And they like Juan, and I do like him too. Mm. I mean, and this is Heathcliff, and this is all this kind of thing. And I don't think that Heathcliff was written by a woman.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. I've never heard a woman say that she loves Marty. Everybody loves Cole.
Exactly. Exactly. And it's not about the fact that Matthew McConaughey is better looking than Woody Harrelson, because that's absolutely subjective.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it is. It's the character. It's obviously, it's not put there, Woody Harrelson, for you to fall for him. But I think none of them are put there to you fall for him. But it's not just that Matthew McConaughey is more attractive, because that's subjective. It's that he's objectified to be that. Is everything is put there to, so you like him,
yes.
And not Marty, because Marty is your husband, okay?
But it's interesting.
And Russ will never be your husband. And that was hot. And that is a problem, yes, but that's eroticism and that's fiction.
But
that's how we put that in fiction.
But it's also interesting with what you said earlier when you called him a psychopath. I mean, he's a psychopath, yes, but also he's a psychopath with empathy.
Yeah.
And this is also what people can feel about him, that he cares, that there is a depth to him that you can't find in Marty, perhaps.
Yeah, it's true. I think he wants to be a psychopath more than he is.
Mm-hmm.
And but in the end, you know, he's a, because psychopaths, but yeah, they are not supposed to have empathy, but he has. He tries not to, hard, but... in the end, it's Marty. Marty even recognizes it at one point. He says, it was my sin was to be indifferent, or, you know, not realizing things, not seeing things. No, he realizes that his sin was not being empathic, not being a womanizer. That wouldn't be that bad if he had paid attention, which he didn't. And I think that's one of the reasons why... that is very interesting, the character of Maggie. Even at the end, when she's questioned for Rust, he defends him, and he's a very loyal man.
Yeah.
And well, she has a crush on him, of course.
Well, thank you so much for this wonderful...
No, thank you.
...of True Detective Season 1.
Just one last question that we ask to all our guests before we close. We always...
Yeah.
If you think of a question which we haven't asked and that we should have asked.
That you wish we had
you
asked.
Wish we had asked.
Oh, I think we pretty much covered it. No, I mean, what? I'm looking at my notes around here. Well, maybe the music. But because I'm a big music fan, and the music is very important in the show.
Yes.
And that would be the same as, you know, in Twin Peaks, the music is very, very important. And in this one too, I think not that obviously, that obvious, let's say, but the fact that I think the other piece is the director, the writer, but also the soundtrack by T-Bone Burnett. Like, it's not just a guy, it's T-Bone Burnett. And I think all the songs are there for a reason. And of course, I investigated that because I'm an obsessive music fan, but that would be something for next time to delve into music.
I feel like he was such a talented musician, but also a musicologist in gathering songs from so many different important genres. And it's so emblematic in the series.
Yeah.
So, Mariana Enriquez, thank you so much for this hour and a half of discussion about True Detective. It was wonderful to have you for this episode of After Images.
No, thank you very much. And I hope I made myself clear, because, you know, it's early and sometimes English doesn't come like in the morning.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to After Images. Please subscribe on your favorite podcast app and follow After Images Podcast on social media.